the Bucks beat San Antonio yesterday, 106-103. The Bulls had the day off. Bucks and Bulls are both off tonight. NHL Blackhawks off last night. Tonight they host San Jose. NCAA Tournament Elite Eight games yesterday. Kansas beat Duke. Villanova beat Texas Tech. So the Final Four now all set for next Saturday. Loyola of Chicago plays Michigan in the first game. It will then be Villanova and Kansas in the second game. The championship game is set for Monday, April 2nd. Now that WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Monday, the 26th of March. Sunny for most of the day. Then becoming cloudy late this afternoon, high 47. Sun is shining right now. The sky is blue. Wind is from the east-southeast at 9. 35 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, featuring Easter candy, new apparel, and garden accessories in its recently remodeled gift shop. Open Monday through Friday from 9 until 6 and Saturday from 9 until 5. More information at jackandrea.com. Support for WGTD and the morning show also comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management and health information management technology. Online degrees for emerging careers from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside in partnership with UW Extension. To learn more, visit uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are looking at one of the most important nations in the world for the next few minutes. We're talking about China. And specifically about China's economy, an economy which, to a large extent, is misunderstood by much of the world, which tends to think of China itself and its economy as a juggernaut of extraordinary, maybe even unparalleled power in a rapid and uninterruptible ascent. And the author of the book at hand, China's Great Wall of Debt, sees this differently, and he's not alone, but the book that he has written is certainly a very persuasive sort of call to attention. His name is Denny McMahon, and he completed his work on this book while a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C., but has lived extensively in the nation of China, in fact, over the course of 13 years, first as a student and then as a financial journalist. He has seen China up close. He has seen it as this economy sort of went into a new gear, and he has seen the signs, as of other experts as well, that not all is right, that there are signs that, in fact, China's economic boon is fragile and that there is the possibility of something very negative right around the corner, and there are already signs of it, even when one travels through China, if you know where to look. It's a really fascinating book told from a number of different perspectives. And Denny McMahon has spoken with everyone from bureaucrats to the poorest of farmers in China to paint a very rich, textured picture of China and its economy in the early 21st century. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. Denny McMahon is currently a fellow at Macropolo, a China-focused think tank based in Chicago. Denny McMahon, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me, Greg. It's great talking to you.
Tell us about your initial encounter with China. You tell us of your first Chinese language lesson back in 1988 when you were just 9 years old. Explain why a nine-year-old was studying Chinese.
Well, that's not that unusual these days. I'm not sure if you saw, but President Trump's grandchildren actually study Chinese, and they've actually, you know, sang in Chinese for the Chinese ambassador in Washington. But in the late 80s, that was pretty unusual, even in Australia, where I'm from. So the reason I was learning the language is my dad was working for one of Australia's big mining companies. He spent his entire career in mines. And he came back from overseas one day on a work trip and said that he was embarrassed that he could only speak one language. I was going to learn an Asian language, and specifically, I was going to learn Chinese. And the reason was he was starting to see China play a more significant role in the global economy. So what he says is that as he traveled around the world on trips, he was seeing Chinese buying, you know, Chinese officials buying commodity metals where they hadn't even a couple of years prior. But I think the big thing was about 3 months before I had my Chinese lesson, Sinosteel, which is one of China's big state-owned enterprises, made the first major investment by a Chinese firm or by a Chinese state overseas. And that was in an iron ore mine in the west of Australia called Channa. And the significance of that mine is to get to it, you've got to fly into a town, a mine called Parabadu. And not only had Dad used to work there, but 15 years earlier, he built the town as mine manager. And that was to feed Japan's great economic boom at the time. They wanted as much iron ore as Australia could mine. And so Dad had, all of a sudden, China had jumped into my father's life in a very significant way. And he saw it as being a major economy in the future and kind of figured, well, someone better learn the language.
So that was you. And of course, that although you described being initially reluctant, ultimately you really fell under the spell of China and ended up doing some studies there and ultimately worked there for quite a few years. And you tell us that as you first became acquainted with China in the 1990s, we're talking about an era in which I believe you describe it as there being a seemingly inevitable and unambiguously good situation in terms of China's economic ascent, that it was without parallel and, in a sense, without blemish, without any cause for concern whatsoever, just something inevitable that was just meant to be an example of exceptionalism in maybe its purest form. At what point did you begin to see a different situation than that very rosy one from early on?
I think it's really, I think as a journalist, things started to change because when I started as a reporter for Dow Jones Newswires in 2005, you're kind of forced to see behind the shiny facade and start to understand the mechanics of how the place works. But it was probably only at the end of 2009, at the beginning of 2010, when I started writing for the Wall Street Journal, and that was about a year after the global financial crisis. It was about a year after China had sort of flicked the switch and launched this massive stimulus program to try and see the Chinese economy through the global financial crisis, which it did quite successfully. But it was at that point that I started seeing this sort of debt start to accumulate very quickly in the economy. And it wasn't just debt, because, you know, debt can do some good things. But it was the excess and the waste and the risk-taking that started to accumulate. And so for me, the alarm bells started to ring in 2010, and they just got louder and louder over the next few years.
You tell us that it's actually a little bit difficult to calculate exactly what China's debt is at the moment. That is, there are different estimations of what it is. But what is beyond question is the fact that the rapidity with which that debt has been built is without a doubt cause for great alarm.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the key. Because by some measures, the China's total overall debt burden relative to the size of its economy is not that different from the United States, probably a little bit higher, but, you know, all told, kind of in the same ballpark. But the issue here is that China has piled on the debt at an incredible pace. And the reason that's a cause to worry is because as more and more debt, the pace at which the debt is piled on affects the degree to which you can actually find productive ways to productive places to put the money. So often what you'll find in other economies that have experienced this comparably very fast build-up of debt is that, you know, it stops going into productive areas and it starts going into things like speculation. So if you look at other countries that have had a similarly rapid accumulation of debt, we're talking about places like the United States prior to the subprime crisis, or Thailand prior to the Asian financial crisis, or Japan prior to its lost decade, or Spain prior to the Eurozone crisis. Except that in China, sure, speculation is an issue, but a lot of this sort of debt is kind of going into slightly unusual areas as well. So if I can give you an example, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have probably heard of China's ghost cities before. So a ghost city kind of takes the concept of a ghost town and turns it upside down, puts it on its head. So in the US, California and Colorado are dotted with ghost towns, which were sprung up overnight in the middle of a gold rush, and then the resources ran out and everybody left. Well, China's ghost towns are sort of an order of magnitude bigger. They're probably cities. And it's not that people left, it's just that they were built and they never attracted the population that they were built to accommodate in the first place. And the thing is, the reason these places are built is not out of sort of necessarily purely out of speculation, but they're built basically as a tool to generate economic growth. So you've got local officials in China. They're judged primarily on their ability to be able to drive the economy and expand the well-being of people in their community. But invariably, you know, local mayors and senior county officials, they're only given that role for maybe 5 years tops. A lot of them are moved onwards and upwards after 3 or 4 years. And that's not a lot of time to be able to prove yourself. And so the easiest way to drive growth for people like that is to borrow money and to build something, because they get the kick immediately to growth from the construction work. But when it comes to actually paying off the debt, well, that becomes somebody else's problem because they've already moved on by the time that it's due. And so that's one of the problems that's sort of driving this problem of debt. It's not entirely speculation, but it's the mechanics of the system means that local governments, provinces, cities, counties, and state firms have this incentive to borrow money in the expectation that they'll probably, as individuals, they're probably never going to have to be responsible for it.
Mm. And so some bad choices are being made, and a lot of things are perhaps being built that don't need to be built, or built in the wrong place, or built to create things that there's already enough of, or who knows, but all kinds of poor choices being made. And you tell us that we not only see this in some of these ghost cities, but in empty apartment towers, in government office buildings that are mostly empty, and also in certain factories. Why don't you choose one of the factories that you visited and saw for yourself, in which you saw this unmistakable evidence that this was a factory that, in a sense, perhaps it should never have been built and was barely off the ground?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there was one factory that I visited, and the reason I originally started writing about this company, and it's called Arzhong, and that's the Chinese name, and it means second heavy, or China's second heavy manufacturing company, machinery company. And what it produces is, it is a factory that produces other factories. So, for example, it will produce all the components that you need to build a nuclear power plant, for example, or it will produce the components that you need to make a steel mill. It also produces some of the biggest components you need for cargo ships. Anyway, I started writing about this company because it had this incredibly large forge, what they call a closed die hydraulic press forge. And this wasn't supposed to be a story about the waste and the futility, the waste and the excess of China's economy. This was supposed to be a story about sort of the strength and the innovation of the Chinese economy, because this machine was built to produce the sort of components that you need for to produce, you know, fighter jets and passenger planes, and it was going to be essential to the development of China's aerospace industry. So the United States has got machines like this. It's had them since the Second World War. What they do is they exert a massive amount of downward pressure on a piece of metal, be it tungsten or steel, and the whole point is to kind of produce, you know, high quality, extremely strong but extremely light components that you can use in aircraft. Anyway, so the US has got these machines, the Russians have got these machines, and this machine that the Chinese built was the biggest of its kind. And so the idea was that China would now be able to produce bigger and lighter components than any other place in the world, with the upshot being that it would potentially be able to produce bigger planes in the future. Now, the problem with all of this is that China doesn't actually need the machine. It doesn't produce, it doesn't have the sort of industries that actually need the sort of components that the machine is currently capable of. And the thing is, the company had accumulated such an enormous amount of debt in terms of building this machine and building other facilities it didn't need. And it's what you ultimately call a zombie company, sort of factory that China just doesn't need and will struggle to actually find a use for.
Wow. And, of course, it's one of a number of such examples in China. Among many things you say in your book is that there is a common misconception about the Chinese economy that it is driven by exports. And you tell us that it used to be, but it has not really been that, to that extent at least, for more than a decade. When did that shift and why?
You know, it shifted sort of in the early 2000s. And the reason was, I mean, certainly after China joined the WTO, the World Trade Organization, in 2001, that was an incredible boost to the economy. But after a while, you know, this sort of need to keep the economy growing quickly at all costs kind of started to shift the balance of power between sort of, you know, exports as a driver and investment, that being the construction of stuff as the driver. So certainly in the early days, you know, China has this huge need to build new housing, build infrastructure in order to facilitate this massive migration of people from the countryside to the cities. And, you know, given the sort of the export machine, that the sort of the driver, this driver of growth, China needed more infrastructure as well. It needed better ports, it needed more power, you know, power plants. And then what really happened was that in the couple around the global financial crisis, what happened is that, you know, demand for China's exports fell significantly, and that it wasn't going to so much be the driver of growth anymore, and so something else needed to drive growth. And so that sort of, then you really saw this transition towards construction and investment as being the bedrock of what we see as being the Chinese economic miracle.
Right, a miracle that seems to be over. You tell us in your book that there has been a calls of alarm about this from a number of different quarters. A number of different books have already been written and so on. In a sense, yours is the latest in a stream of them. You also tell us that it is not that the nation of China itself is unaware. And you tell us that the president of China, for instance, seems to be deeply aware and deeply concerned about the situation. How hopeful are you that China is going to be able to sort out the proper means to address this alarming situation?
I'm not hugely hopeful, and that's for a couple of reasons. I mean, one is that the issue that they're facing is it's not simply this debt problem. It's not simply that its economic model is so wasteful and really needs to change. It's that China's facing another number of other economic challenges at this moment as well. So one is that China's not as, you know, we usually see China as a very cheap place to manufacture things. But China's not so cheap anymore. The cost of everything from land to energy to wages has been rising very aggressively. And that sort of feeds into another challenge that China is facing, which is this rapidly aging population. China has one of the fastest aging populations in the world, and that's the direct fallout of the one-child policy. So we've already seen I think starting in 2012, that the working age population in China is falling. Over the next decade, it's going to fall by tens of millions. Now, that is going to cost drive up the cost of wage, what people have to pay for wages. And it's also going to add this additional burden on the government because they need to spend more on providing services to retirees. So in some ways, at this moment, it's kind of a perfect storm of economic challenges. It's the debt. It's the wasteful economic model. It's the aging population. It's the declining competitiveness. And although the government recognizes the problems and it's trying to come up with a solution, it's really in uncharted territory. It might have a solution in mind, and it's certainly, you know, driving to try and, you know, come up with new drivers of growth, but there's no guarantees that it's going to work.
On that unsettling note, we leave it, but we leave it to our listeners to explore your fascinating book further. Again, it's China's Great Wall of Debt, Shadow Banks, Ghost Cities, Massive Loans, and the End of the Chinese Miracle, published by Houghton Mifflin, the author, Dinny McMahon. Dinny McMahon, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show, and thank you for writing such a potentially important and fascinating book.
Thanks, Craig. It's been great talking to you.
And the time is 8:30 here on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio. We're going to finish out the hour with an interview from the Morning Show archives, an interview that goes all the way back to 2003, 15 years ago.
This is the bicentennial year for a very important, indeed a momentous occasion in U.S. history, the Louisiana Purchase. And if you want to explore this important chapter in our early history, then you need to find Charles Cerami's beautiful new book entitled Jefferson's Great Gamble, the remarkable story of Jefferson, Napoleon, and the men behind the Louisiana Purchase. This book is just out and really gives some remarkable insights into this chapter in our history, which is so important and yet badly misunderstood. And so I'm pleased that we have Charles Cerami with us for a few minutes to speak with us about this book and his study of the Louisiana Purchase. Charles Cerami, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Good to be with you, Greg.
Give us some sense, first of all, of what kind of led to the writing of this book specifically, and was it an idea of yours or someone else's?
That's my favorite question, as a matter of fact. Yes, it was an idea of mine. I had come across a couple of books that supposedly were about the Louisiana Purchase that had been written 25 to 30 years ago, and I noticed how little attention they gave to the negotiation. That there were only a couple of chapters devoted to how this thing was pulled off by the participants, and the chapters were early things going back to the explorations of La Salle, or later things looking at what the effects of this were. But here was the biggest thing that ever happened to the United States, biggest thing that's ever happened to any country, to double in size suddenly like this, and you pass off the actual negotiation with just a couple of chapters. It seemed to me strange that when fine writers who write good biographies of an individual person, when they write about events somehow, they just make it sound as though a few men in dark suits went into a room, signed a paper, and that was all there was to it. So I began to look into who were the people who pulled this off. And I've had just incredible luck with this book because I found all sorts of materials with the greatest ease right here in my own Library of Congress in Washington. I can't do any of the usual complaining about the horrors of research over trying to read old letters and so on, because all these had been brought up to speed and were easy for me to read. And I soon found that I was meeting nine of the most interesting men who have ever lived, really. There were four negotiators on each side, and then there was one man who wasn't even a government employee, but his name was the well-known name of DuPont, same name as the big company we know of, and these people were so interesting, some of them a little bit weird, not all were somebody you would trust with your family finances, but they all had something to put into this that was really fascinating to me, and my great fortune is that everybody seems to agree with it. I'm hearing a lot of people say that it reads like a novel.
Right. I want to just explore a moment further this sort of research phase of putting the book together. I guess I'm particularly curious because I had the pleasure a few months ago of actually interviewing the Librarian of Congress. And as he talked about the treasures to be found there, now to have the opportunity to speak with someone who's actually put them to tangible use is very tempting indeed. I'm curious, when one walks into a place like the Library of Congress with a specific research topic like the Louisiana Purchase in mind, then where do you go? What do you do? How are things organized there to help you find all the marvelous things that you did?
Yes. Well, like most things dealing with agencies, you have to try a number of different doors and call a number of different phone numbers, but it's relatively easy to zero in on this. I came finally to a thing that in a new building of the Library of Congress, which is a beautiful, bright, airy, wonderful place to work, and it's called the Law Library. And I don't know why these things happen to be in that place, but the wonderful thing that happened 100 years ago when it was only the 100th anniversary of the Louisiana Purchase was that Congress, apparently with me in mind, decided that there ought to be a separate file of all the documents that had been exchanged, letters and other documents, in that negotiation. And these things wound up in the Library of Congress and somehow got to this law library. And when I went in to find it and told them what my aim was, they assigned a desk to me. It was the pleasantest place in the world to work, and the desk meant that I could leave papers all over it, go away for a week and come back. Nothing would be touched. And then pretty soon these letters were put in front of me that I could read the exchanges that were going on between Washington, D.C. and Paris, the two places where the negotiation took place. And, Jefferson was the president at that time. Remember, this is exactly 200 years ago now, almost to the day. It was in about April 28th of 1803 was the first time that that three men got together and said, we're going to do this deal. Just verbally said that, and the following day they initialed it, and the day after that they signed it in a more formal way. So there's a string of 4 or 5 days that can be called the anniversary, but we're right in the middle of that anniversary period.
We certainly are. Were you able to hold these documents in your hands?
Well, these were not the original letters. These were that was my good fortune, because
right.
You can imagine how much trouble it would be to read things like that
of 200
course. Years later. These had been gone over and then digitized and then put into microfiche, that one of those techniques that miniaturizes things, and you do have to get the knack of working the little machine and so on. And then pretty soon, the whole thing appeared on the little screen in front of me. So I was reading the letters as easily as you read your morning newspaper. But they were unquestionably, taken exactly from the letters with misspellings and everything else that might have occurred.
Interesting. You mentioned the fact that, and you're absolutely right, of course, that the history books have tended to kind of shunt aside this potentially fascinating chapter in terms of how Louisiana Purchase actually came about. It's almost as though historians have sort of bought into this principle of manifest destiny, that this is just always the way it was going to be and had to be, and history just sort of swept in this direction.
Yes.
And of course, the actual story is more complicated than that.
More complicated, though it's true that it sort of gives rise sometimes to the thought that, by golly, this must have been something predestined. how could so many things have fallen into place so well? Because you have the fact, for instance, that it would not have happened, not in this way, if there had not been this terrible outbreak of yellow fever on the island of Santo Domingo. Now, I'm sure you don't want me to explain that whole thing, but Napoleon had some troops that were on their way to Louisiana, which would have caused a totally different outcome here. If he had landed troops there, who knows whether we would have somehow finally stirred in a way to really confront him. But we had less than 1,000 men in uniform, and he was sending as many as maybe 40,000 troops. But they stopped off to put down a rebellion on this island of Santo Domingo, which was half French. And it happened that yellow fever hit with the strongest intensity that it ever had. And these fellows from Europe who had no immunity like the natives just died like flies. I mean, they had groups of men where 3,000 had landed a couple of weeks earlier, and they were down to 100 men.
Wow.
And so Napoleon was getting frantic letters to send more men just to hold on to Santo Domingo, much less going on. So they never got to Louisiana. At the same time, there were things going on between Jefferson and Madison, who was his Secretary of State, who decided they were going to try to really terrify Napoleon, to make him see what a mistake it would be to try to land. And they pulled off wonderful stunts between them. I mean, like playing good cop, bad cop in their discussions with the French ambassador and exaggerating how big the population of our western areas had grown, that would be the areas up near the Mississippi, making it seem as though we had a population all armed with rifles who were going to make life hell for any kind of people who landed, even though they would be coming into territory that they legally owned. And so Jefferson was the hero of scaring these people away. And finally, in the end, when you got to 1803, after many discussions, Napoleon just decided he'd better take some cash and get out of this whole picture.
I suppose we could say that they were trying to paint a picture as inhospitable as possible.
Exactly.
Thing that your remarks remind us, of course, is the fact that we're talking about a point so early in United States history that the U.S. is in no way at this point a formidable world power. So this was really, in a sense, an audacious undertaking.
Yes. You know, it's strange when you go back and study so much that you feel at the end of each day as though you're really living in that century, in the 1800 rather than 2000. It's strange to realize what a world power kind of effect the U.S. had on all other countries, even when it was a relatively small country. And at that time, as you say, it was just a strip of these former colonies, now states, that were running down the East Coast. In many places, it didn't go much deeper than about 50 miles into the rest of the continent. But then there had been, just in the few years before this 1800 period, there had been a big surge of people starting to move west and into the beautiful Ohio Valley, and even going up to the banks of the Mississippi. And so the Mississippi River was our west coast at that time. And it was one of the reasons we were so excited about this whole subject, that if anybody controlled New Orleans, and that could still be true today, the control of New Orleans could open or block the way to running ships up and down the Mississippi River, that is, running them out of the river and into the wide world beyond. So already at that time, about 3/8 of our total foreign trade, in other words, getting to be close to a half, was going from Mississippi ports. And so we weren't about to let a power like France control that city, even though technically they had the legal right to it because they had a treaty taking it from Spain. So they, legally they could have been in New Orleans, but they had never managed to get their troops to take control yet.
We're speaking with Charles Cerami. He is the author of a book entitled Jefferson's Great Gamble, the remarkable story of Jefferson, Napoleon, and the men behind the Louisiana Purchase. It is the 200th anniversary of the Louisiana Purchase. Mr. Cerami, give us some sense of what the French knew about this area in North America, which came to be known as the Louisiana Purchase. I'm curious to have a sense of whether or not they really knew everything that they were giving up. I mean, did they really have a full grasp of just what was there?
Mm-hmm. You're asking some pretty deep questions, a little more than I usually get, and I appreciate it because it is interesting that the French had the feeling that they got along better with the Indian population here, the Native Americans, than any other people. And it was true somehow. I don't know what was the cause of it, but going way back when the French had first landed under La Salle and so on, they got along reasonably well with the Native Americans. And then later on, there were French trappers living close by the Indians, and a few of them had even taken Indian brides. And so it was one of the things that made Napoleon think that he had an advantage there, that if they landed in New Orleans and then fanned out, and you know, when we talk about Louisiana, we're talking about that whole territory, not just the area that we made into a state, but a territory that going all the way up to the Canadian border, from which, as you know, more than 13 whole states were of our present states were made from this acquisition.
Right.
And it's true that the French knew quite a lot about it, enough so that Napoleon had talked sometimes about having a new empire in the West. But, you know, we had gotten accustomed in just a very few years to the idea that we weren't supposed to have neighbors. The United States had an attitude that was different from any other country in the world, made the others think we were arrogant then, just the way they sometimes think it now, that we thought we were very special. We were, because we had this great open area before us, and a lot of Americans had the feeling. In fact, Jefferson had said in his first inaugural address in 1801, when he was actually inaugurated, that however much our present interests may restrain us within our own limits, it's impossible not to look forward to distant times when we will cover the whole continent with a people speaking the same language, governed in similar forms, and by similar laws. I'm reading that, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't memorize all of Lincoln's words, but they're all worth listening to, because he was a scoundrel in many ways, you know, but he could be a most enchanting user of words.
Well, and clearly a man of extraordinary vision.
Yeah. He and Madison shared this idea of hoping that we would go from sea to shining sea. And the wonderful thing about it was that Madison was able, in trying to fool the French ambassador, to convince that very bright young man that he really didn't want to see the United States expand, that he was afraid, that he was one of those people, of whom there were many, who thought that if we got beyond a certain size, it would be impossible to control such a huge area. And Madison pretended to the French ambassador that was his feeling, and so he begged him to try to keep the French from landing any troops there, because he thought that would force us to try to get them out and gradually force us to cross the Mississippi River and take new areas where he didn't want to see us go, because that would be too big for us. And this was conveyed to Napoleon, you know, who must have been really in a considerable confusion over the things he was hearing.
And he apparently believed enough of what was being said that he mistook us to be a more formidable opponent than we would have been.
Yes. Oh, among other things, too, there's a funny little thing about Napoleon. You would think that a man with his huge intelligence operation, which he controlled as a dictator and so on, would not be boastful about what he had just read in the newspaper. But somehow he was very proud of the fact that the London newspapers reached him within 2 days. And he always read things in his London paper that seemed to be sometimes ahead of what his intelligence service knew. So he had read in the London paper, this is toward the end of the negotiating time, he had read that over in our Congress that one Senator Ross had proposed that we raise 50,000 troops at once to defend New Orleans. And another senator had proposed a bill of making 15 gunboats to patrol the Mississippi. And Napoleon read all that and saw that it appeared that the Congress of the United States, which he knew represented the people, was terribly stirred up about this subject. And it was another one of the things that convinced him, look, if I can get $20 million or so for this, I guess I'm better off to take it. He actually got less than that, as you know, but our total cost was $15 million.
You've already mentioned the fact that our third president and the man who became our fourth were quite instrumental. Another name that comes up is the fifth president of the United States, James Monroe, who I believe was one of the gentlemen dispatched to Paris once negotiations were actually underway.
That's right. And he was a much more interesting man than history has made him out to be. I've often thought that he deserves a good, fresh biography, but when I've discussed it with anybody in the publishing field, they say, Madison's not sexy. Now Jefferson, they always say, is sexy. meaning a lively subject. They somehow don't realize the things that Madison did as president. He became, he made himself so universally popular in his first administration that he was actually reelected by acclamation, that is, without a single dissenting vote. It happened, though, that one of the electors felt that nobody but George Washington should ever have that honor. And so he cast his ballot for John Quincy Adams just as a lone vote, just in order to break it up for Monroe. But that was how effective a president he later became. At this time, when he went over to negotiate, he faced, I think, one of the sternest tests that any American ever has in all our history. He landed in Paris, having been briefed by Jefferson and Madison, with whom he was a very close personal friend, and they had briefed him on everything that he could possibly face over in France. Here's what you do if Napoleon offers a piece of Florida, the West or East Florida. Here's what you would do if he offers to give us the right to navigate the Mississippi. Here's how much you could pay, and so on. When he gets there, he immediately learns from Robert Livingston, the ambassador we had already had there for 2 years, that a new thing has been proposed. Napoleon is offering to sell the entire Louisiana Territory, something nobody had ever thought of. And Monroe knows that if he says, well, wait, I have to contact my superiors in Washington to talk about this, the whole deal would probably be off, because Napoleon was not the kind of man who would wait 3 months for a letter to get there and a return to come back. So he had to make the decision really alone. He and Livingston did it together, technically, but he was the one who had been sent to negotiate on this purpose. So he knew it was his responsibility. he had the title of plenipotentiary, meaning having full power. So if he put his signature onto a treaty, it had the same strength as if the president signed it himself. And he knew that there were many people in America that didn't think we had any business going west, many people who thought that a bigger country would collapse into separate pieces and so on, and that he might go home and be impeached or just laughed out of existence. But he decided that this price that he was going to offer would seem like a very small amount of money a few years later, as of course it did, and he decided it had to be done.
He of course did so knowing quite confidently that his friends Jefferson and Madison would be behind him, and that had to be significant.
He knew that they would not blame him for the decision he had made, but he didn't know whether they could pull it off politically, because the Congress had talked in little terms about maybe a couple of million dollars. About $2 million was the figure that they said might help to bring some better situation about. They didn't say what the situation would be, what that $2 million would go for, but you can see what small thoughts they had on the subject. And he knew then that it might be getting Jefferson into great trouble politically. The president's the one who would face impeachment for a thing like this. And, of course, the deal would collapse because it would have to be ratified by the Senate. And at one point, incidentally, it was thought that this thing was so questionable that the Senate ratification was going to be a very close fight. You know, what really happened was that from the moment that the American people learned that their country was twice as big as they thought, everybody loved the idea. I mean, I'm exaggerating when there were a few that said, oh, well, we got Manhattan Island for $24. Doesn't $15 million seem like a lot of money to pay for a wilderness? Few little things like that were said, but for the most part, the opposition was very light, and the vote for ratification was 27-6.
So never seriously in doubt then.
That's right.
What do you think, I'm very curious about that fact that there had been some fairly potent opposition to the idea of this kind of wholesale expansion. What do you think happened to that opposition once sort of reality hit? Was it that people were just frightened by the idea of it, but then when it became real, then they were ready to deal with it somehow? Or,
yeah. Well, I guess like many things of this kind, a lot of different things play into it. One of them was that the Federalist Party, that was the party that was mostly dominant in the Northeast, and Alexander Hamilton was the great power in that. And they were the ones who had always been opposed to this expansion to the West. Suddenly, when they saw that the idea of the closure of the Mississippi had a lot of political popularity, I mean, that people were writing to their congressmen to take some action here, don't let this happen, and so on, the Federalists began to think that they could expand their grip if they started befriending the Western people. So they did start making more noise than the Republicans, who were Jefferson's party, more noise about protecting the Mississippi. That was one factor in it. But mainly, I think it was just the concept, as you and I might have if we suddenly found that man could travel to a nearby planet, and by golly, we owned it. The United States of America suddenly had acquired another planet. These people thought of their country as of a certain size, and suddenly they learned that it was actually going to be bigger than the whole continent of Europe. And that idea was just so mind-boggling that everybody went for it.
Wow. And history changes.
Yes.
The book is Jefferson's Great Gamble, the remarkable story of Jefferson, Napoleon, and the men behind the Louisiana Purchase. And its author, Charles Cerami, has been joining us today on The Morning Show. Mr. Cerami, a wonderful book and a wonderful pleasure to speak with you today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
It's been fun talking to you.
Again, that interview was from 15 years ago, 2003, which marked the centennial year of the Louisiana Purchase. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I look forward to welcoming back into our studios Dr. Yuri Maltsev, professor of economics at Carthage College. We will be talking with him primarily about the recent re-election of President Vladimir Putin and the state of affairs between the United States and Russia. We'll also get his thoughts on the Robert Mueller investigation, potential ties between President Trump and President Putin, and also his thoughts